It's 12:30. We're going to start the meeting on time. We don't have a quorum yet, but I don't start late. And when we have a quorum, we'll officially start the meeting. The first item on our agenda is a bill. We don't have a house file number yet, but that hasn't stopped us in the past, and it's not going to stop us today. The bill that we have in front of us is the Transportation Choices 2020 funding proposal, and Chair Earhart will be carrying this bill. My understanding is that you have to go to another hearing,
right,
and we'll introduce the bill, and then we'll carry on from there. We have allotted a total of 50 minutes for this bill today. We have a very full agenda. I will stick to that time frame and ask the presenters that they help monitor the amount of time so that all the presenters that you want to have an opportunity to speak will fit within that 50-minute time frame. Welcome to the committee, Chair Earhart, if you'd like to explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and if you have a member here, oh, we do have two members. Glad to see you today, folks.
Well, I think you can count yourself and myself and double
the
number.
That's good. Okay. Anyway, I'm just going to give you a quick overview because I do have to go and present another bill at 12:30. And so the Transit 2020 initiative would provide some increased stable and secure funding for transit and for bicycle pedestrian projects in Minnesota. So it would do essentially four things. Fund full implementation. Thank you. Of the transit portion of Met Council's transportation policy by 2020 rather than carrying it out to 2030. It'll compress, in other words, Met Council's transportation policy plan for the expansion of bus service, park and ride capacity, and 8 dedicated transit ways, both bus and rail. Two, it would provide revenues to local units of government and metropolitan area to allocate toward transit, bicycle, and pedestrian projects. And three, it would expand transit in greater Minnesota to all counties, extend service to more municipalities within counties, and provide more evening and weekend service in greater Minnesota. Four, it would allocate money for planning and design of high-speed rail as part of the Midwest High-Speed Rail Initiative. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to these two very able ladies to my right, and I will make my goodbyes for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Earhart, and good luck with your other bill and the other committee. Welcome to the committee. So state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barb Pillman. I'm the Program Director for Transit for Livable Communities. We're pleased to be able to provide have the opportunity today to talk with you on behalf of a coalition of organizations that's come together in support of transit expansion, bicycling, and walking. In the room today, we have citizens from across the metro region and also from greater Minnesota, and they're here with us to demonstrate the support for transit, biking, and walking for this initiative in particular. We appreciate the opportunity to have 50 minutes, and what we'll do is I will explain the proposal sort of in general. I'll talk more specifically about the metro portion of it. Sherry Munyon will talk about greater Minnesota, and then we have a number of testifiers that have will speak for a minute or two each about
great.
The bill. So, thank you. So the bill should have a bill number this afternoon. And thanks to a number of members of the committee, we have bipartisan support in this body and also in the Senate. This bill would greatly expand transportation choices in Minnesota. It would provide for statewide expansion of transit and also for local bike and pedestrian facilities within the metropolitan area. Representative Earhart talked a little bit about the bill. Again, just to reiterate, it would fund full implementation of the transit portion of the Met Council's transportation policy plan, including expanded bus service, new park and ride capacity, 8 dedicated transit ways, both bus and rail, by 2020 rather than 2030 or some date beyond. We currently have no funding to implement the Met Council's 2030 plan. It would also provide revenue to local units of government in the metropolitan area to allocate for transit, bicycle, and pedestrian projects. It would enable the expansion of transit in greater Minnesota to all counties, extend service to more municipalities within counties, and provide evening and weekend service. And finally, it would allocate money for planning and design of high-speed rail as part of the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative. We know that you have heard about a number of other transportation proposals, and we're really pleased that there are so many proposals on the table this year. We've put this proposal together because we don't find the other proposals to be strong enough in the area of transit, and let me tell you why. Most of these other proposals do not provide revenue soon enough to prevent major cuts in transit service, and they would require that another fare increase would go into effect. None of them fully fund transit to enable us to build our transit systems in greater Minnesota or the metro by 2020, and none of them provide revenue that we think is stable enough like the revenue we have on the roadside. So when we look to other major metropolitan areas around the United States or Canada or even across the world to see what they're doing in the area of transportation, we find that transit is a key component of their strategies going forward. It's not just a poor stepsister to the highway side. In most other regions, transit is viewed as being as important as maintaining and expanding the regional highway system, and transit receives an equivalent level of investment. Today, despite the welcome addition of the Hiawatha Light Rail Line to Minnesota, the Twin Cities continues to have a low level of investment in transit, fewer miles of rail, lower transit ridership than our peers. So why 2021 at 2030 or 2040? Well, it's because we think we need to put transit on a much faster track. We're already 10 years behind our peer cities, and we don't have the luxury of moving forward in a slow, methodical way. In the area of transitways, which are really the backbone of a 21st century transit system, we see that Dallas has 44 miles of rail, Portland 44 miles, San Diego 47, and Denver has just approved the funding to add another 119 miles of rail over the next 12 years, and all these systems have mature bus systems and are proposing improved connections on the bus side. So while they're moving forward, we're moving backward. This bill is intended to enable Minnesota to move forward aggressively on transit. It provides the funding to implement the transit plans for the metro and greater Minnesota that are already on the books, plans that have been gathering dust because of a lack of funding. Transit needs dedicated funding like Minnesota has for roads, and as Minnesota has had for roads for many decades. While the dedicated gas tax and license tab fees provide roads in Minnesota with reliable funding, they provide the highway side with about $100 million for expansion annually, or have over the course of the 1990s. Transit does not have this. Transit is not even guaranteed enough money to maintain the existing system. This year, Greater Minnesota and the metro area transit systems are expecting the largest shortfall in decades. In the metropolitan area, the shortfall is $60 million for the biennium. So Metro Transit is planning for a 8 to 10% service reduction and fare increases across the board. Transportation Choices 2020 would change this. It uses two funding sources that raise a total of $365 million annually, which is the amount needed to build out transit systems statewide in 15 years. We worked with staff from the Met Council, from the Metropolitan Transitways Development Board, and also from the Minnesota Public Transit Agency and MnDOT to help put these numbers together. And then we hired an accounting firm to review and improve these spreadsheets. The bill institutes a half-cent regional sales tax in the 7-county metropolitan area. That money would be split in two ways. 85% of the money, and this, the information about the specifics of the bill should be in a handout that you got in your packet. There's a bill summary, and that's what I'm going to, it's going to be more detailed than what you have, but I will just describe it briefly.
And if I may interrupt for just a moment, we can now officially call the meeting to order, and Representative Hausman moves approval of the minutes for the March 8th committee meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Sorry for the interruption. If you can continue. And the summary packet is that's in your folder is this one, members. Thank you.
Thank you. 85% of the sales tax, about $191 million annually, would go to the Met Council for Metro Transit, the opt-outs, Metro Mobility, and other transit service for capital and operating costs of bus, rail, and paratransit. The sales tax would provide the majority of the money needed to implement the Council's transit plan by 2020. 15% of the money, which is about $34 million annually, would be passed through to cities and counties on a per capita basis for planning, design, maintenance, construction, promotion, and operation of public transit, bicycle, and pedestrian projects, and for the transportation infrastructure associated with transit-oriented development projects. Today, cities and counties do not have sources of state money to use for their local priorities in transit or to improve infrastructure for walking and bicycling. And more citizens want local communities where walking and bicycling are safe and pleasant. So why a sales tax? Well, the majority of major metropolitan regions around the United States use a sales tax to fund public transit. Those sales taxes range from a half cent to a full cent. In Atlanta, in Cleveland, in Dallas, in Denver, and in Houston, transit receives a full cent of a regional sales tax. Ideally, we'd like to see a transportation-related revenue stream used to fund public transit. But under the current scenario with the constitutional dedication and the language in the Constitution, that doesn't appear to be currently possible. So a half-cent regional sales tax would provide transit with something it doesn't have now, reliable and stable funding and the ability to move forward on additional transit projects. The bill would also increase the percentage of the motor vehicle sales tax dedicated to metropolitan transit from 21.5% to 46% in the metro area and 1.43% to 14% in greater Minnesota over a period of years. And Sherry Munning is going to talk about the greater Minnesota side. On the metro side, we do this for two reasons. First, we want to shift the $57 million in general fund money that's allocated to transit to the motor vehicle sales tax to make that money somewhat more secure, and then to raise the additional money needed to allow for completion of the council's transit plan. The motor vehicle sales tax would be phased in over time, the shift would be phased in over time, to avoid impacting other programs and to provide the increases to the transit budget when they're really needed. The shift would be completed by 2010. There may be other ways to fund the additional transit needs, especially if this bill becomes part of a multimodal bill, and we certainly are open to other ideas. The final thing to point out is that the bill would provide $10 million over the next biennium for planning for high-speed rail from the Twin Cities to Chicago as part of the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative. High-speed rail is a network of fast, reliable train service between major cities in the upper Midwest, and it would provide enable a traveler to get from St. Paul to Chicago in about 4.5 hours. It would provide a viable alternative to air and road travel and relieve pressure on our airports. All of the other upper Midwest states have committed money. They are upgrading track, and some states are even supporting train service, and Minnesota is lagging far behind. So that's the proposal. If it's passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, it would go into effect on July 1st, 2005, and the first money would be available January 1st of 2006. We've seen the strong public support generated by quality transit service, like the express suburban bus routes, Hiawatha light rail, and the promise of projects like the Central Corridor and 35W busways. The public wants convenient and reliable alternatives to sitting in traffic, and they don't want to wait until 2030 or beyond. This bill is one way to provide real choices, and we urge committee members to consider it as you are crafting your transportation proposal.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Sherry Munyon, and I'm representing the Minnesota Public Transit Association. Our goal is to significantly broaden the choices available for moving people in our state. This is actually an exceptional day for us, having a bill in front of the committee that fully meets the needs of public transit, not only in the metro area, but greater Minnesota as well. And the needs that are being talked about today have been identified by MnDOT and the Met Council, although we are recommending a speedier implementation. Public transit is not just for Minnesota's urban areas. It also provides an essential link for Minnesotans living in small towns and rural areas. Many of these residents have limited access to a car, the lack of reliable public transportation in small cities, towns, and rural areas can be a barrier to getting a job and to those seeking to get off public assistance. The population in greater Minnesota is growing and aging. In rural areas, communities are spread over large distances with many needed services concentrated in regional areas. Seniors need to travel long distances to get to medical appointments, nutrition sites, or shopping destinations. Without the local transit service, individuals are much more isolated and experience a lower quality of life. In fact, this can even lead to a need to reside in assisted living facilities, which end up being an even higher state expense. And although senior citizens only make up about 25% of our riders, that population is growing. The state demographer has said that in 2025, 20% of our population will be over 65, and in some rural counties, that number will be significantly higher. Poverty rates are also generally higher in rural Minnesota. In the 2001 MnDOT transportation plan, they identified service needs throughout greater Minnesota, and they also put together an implementation plan. Sadly, however, the gaps that were identified in 2001 have not even begun to be addressed. The same needs identified in 2001 exist today. 15 counties in our state have no countywide transit service. 7 of those counties currently have no public transit service whatsoever. Clearwater, Kennebec, Kitson, Pine, Todd, Waseca, and Wilkin. The MnDOT Transit Plan envisions establishing countywide service in each of these counties by 2010. There are 8 other counties that have transit service only in selected municipalities: Blue Earth, Cass, Freeborn, Le Sueur, Nicollet, Olmsted, Ottertail, and Rice. According to the transit plan, services in those counties would be extended to meet the additional needs in the community and of the customers. And although 65 other counties do have countywide transit service, those levels vary significantly. Community requests exist for extended hours and weekend service, and the transit plan had incorporated those for implementation when funds became available. In most communities in greater Minnesota, transit service ends by late afternoon. In fact, only 11 out of 67 systems operate after 6 p.m., and only about 1/4 of the systems operate on Saturday, while just 11 systems operate on a Sunday. Rural residents really seem to be neglected when it comes to transit funding. These gaps undermine basic mobility for increasing numbers of citizens in greater Minnesota, making it difficult for them to access the needed basic goods and services. MnDOT's existing plan calls for moving steadily towards meeting the transit need by 2030. Implementation of these goals has fallen seriously behind schedule due to a lack of increased state appropriations. Meeting 85% of the need in greater Minnesota by 2010 will require $31 million annually in existing to the current appropriation. In addition, 210 new vehicles will be needed for service, and there's a projected cost of an additional $12.1 million for those expenses. To fully fund Greater Minnesota transit operating and capital needs, by the year 2020, an average of over $60 million a year is required over the 15-year period. Not only aren't we adding service in greater Minnesota, but once again we're facing severe service cuts and fare increases. Approximately $4.5 million would need to be appropriated this year just to preserve our existing system. With the current budget forecast, greater Minnesota transit systems can anticipate a shortfall of about $2 million for the biennium. And it will be worse than that when you factor in inflation, which is projected at 2.8%. These transit systems are dealing with increased costs for fuel, health care, and other expenses. That means that our greater Minnesota transit systems can anticipate a message from the Department of Transportation asking them to reduce the spending under their current contracts by about 5%. So, members, we just want to strongly urge you to forward a package this year that will address the transit needs statewide. And following me, there will be three representatives speaking on behalf of transit systems from Otter Tail County, Dakota County, and St. Louis County. They will describe the challenges they face as providers.
Thank you very much, Ms. Moynihan. Are there any questions for the two testifiers thus far? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, for having this hearing. And I have a question for Ms. Thoman, but before I do, I also want to thank everyone for coming out today. I mean, I haven't been around the legislature very long, but I can't recall a standing room only crowd for a transit hearing in the past. So, but I think it's certainly a message from the grassroots that we ought to take seriously this bill and take seriously our transportation choices. So thank you for coming. Ms. Thoman, I was intrigued by, and you always do such a good job of talking about our peer cities, and so this sheet that's titled Sources of Funding Public Transit in Peer Cities, one argument that's been, I think sometimes people acknowledge, yes, these other cities have these local sales taxes, but you know, here in Minnesota, we have other taxes that may be higher. These are regions or communities that have lower taxes in other areas. How would you respond to that? I agree that in order to be a successful region, we need a first-rate transit system, and I agree that the sales tax is something we really ought to seriously consider, and I support this bill for that reason. But how would you respond to this argument that we're already overtaxed, so we shouldn't do a sales tax? I quite frankly don't see how we raise the money for transit without it, but how would you respond to that argument? It's something we hear from time to time.
Ms. Thoman.
Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein, in these major metropolitan areas around the country, they have sales taxes that are about on par with the sales tax in the Twin Cities region. So imposing an additional half-cent sales tax is not necessarily going to mean that we have a sales tax that's really out of line with our peer cities, and I think you probably know that in many of these cities they have a broader base on which they raise the sales tax. They many of them tax clothing, and we don't here in Minnesota. And I think what a number of these cities have realized is that when you don't have good funding for transit, you end up imposing other penalties, financial penalties, on businesses and on citizens in a region. You end up with businesses in downtowns and in major business centers that have to provide millions and millions of dollars for parking for employees, and that raises the cost of doing business. You end up mandating almost, in a sense, that people have to own one or two or three cars, that they can't substitute a transit pass for a motor vehicle. And so the costs of not doing transit and having a really robust system are really pretty high.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Ms. Gellman, would you clarify, I believe I understood that you said you needed $365 million additional annually. That's over and above what you're getting now. I just wanted to know that for sure. Okay, thank you.
All right.
I have questions, but if they're limited to 50 minutes, I'd just as soon get their other testifiers in before I ask mine.
All right, that works. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Thelman, you mentioned that Minnesota is lagging behind as far as putting money up for high-speed rail, and I'm wondering, I'm looking at the sources of funding table that you passed out, because this high-speed rail between Chicago and Minnesota entails getting Chicago or Illinois, I don't know where you're figuring the train's going to run, but I don't see any of the cities that would be involved with coming up with that money, or has Wisconsin come forward? Have the cities of Madison or Milwaukee or some of those big cities come forward with a proposal? Has Chicago come forward with a proposal for this, because we're supposed to lagging behind and they're ahead of us?
Ms. Bellman.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson. There is a new publication that came out this year, and I can make this, and I can leave this for the committee. It's called the Midwest Regional Rail System, and it was a plan that was put together by the states that participate in the discussions about high-speed rail, and Minnesota is one of those states. Many of the cities have done planning. They have done, many of the Midwest states have done planning. They've done design. Some of them have upgraded track. I grew up in Michigan, and they have been upgrading the track between the border and Detroit over the course of the last 5 years. And so infrequently when I travel home and I ride that train, it's a much better trip than it used to be. The states of Illinois and Wisconsin have actually provided state dollars, not regional dollars, but state dollars to supplement train service between Chicago and Milwaukee so that there can be more trains more frequently on that route.
Ms. Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Ms. Bellman, if you could give me that information, evidence of the fact that Wisconsin and Illinois and the cities that are dealing with the high-speed rail have done that, I'd like to see that.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. The next set of testifiers, welcome to the committee, gentlemen. If you'll state your name for the record prior to your testimony, we would appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Scalgi, and I'm the president of Productive Alternatives Incorporated. Productive Alternatives is a nonprofit organization based in Fergus Falls, which is at Otter Tail County. Our agency's primary purpose is to provide vocational services to persons with disabilities. A major portion of our service delivery is providing transportation to and from work for those persons that we serve. To accomplish this, we have more than 20 vehicles in Otter Tail County and drive hundreds of thousands of miles each year. Several of our larger buses have been purchased through the Department of Transportation 5310 grants over the years. We operate these vehicles from three of our program sites in the county, Fergus Falls, Perham, and Parker's Prairie. From these sites, our current routes cover almost two-thirds of the county. Otter Tail County is one of less than 10 remaining outstate counties throughout the state that does not have a public transit system. Otter Tail is a large county geographically, and much of the area is somewhat remote. Recognizing that our agency has considerable investment into equipment, vehicles, and staff, and that we were covering a good part of the county with our routes, we were approached 4 years ago by the DOT regarding our interest in possibly becoming a provider of public transit services for the county. Historically, in most years, there have been startup grant monies available through the DOT 5311 program. After careful consideration, we invested considerable time and resources into developing a grant proposal to provide public transit services for Otter Tail County. We have held public forums to assess the need for the program, gotten letters of support from a variety of interested parties and potential users of the system, and gotten commitments of support from the county commission and city governments. We have secured our means of support for the matching portion of the grant and have worked to continue to upgrade our current fleet of vehicles. The end result of our efforts is a startup proposal of approximately $895,000, which is a very low cost amount given the size of our county. We estimate the yearly continuation cost to be approximately $600,000. We will be able to better utilize our existing equipment resources, as well as the dollar investment our agency and the county have already made to provide a reasonable cost public transit option. We absorb considerable financial loss annually as an agency to provide our current transportation system, and this project will also help us offset at least some of that loss. We submitted our 5311 grant proposal to the DOT 2 years ago. Unfortunately, there has been no money available in the DOT budget the last 2 years for startup grants. We would ask for your consideration that our request for dollars be placed in the DOT budget this year to support our startup and continuation process. Our county is a large rural area with a number of small communities made up increasingly of senior citizens whose transportation options are few. We can provide a low-cost startup, maximize the private and public dollars that have already been put into our transit system, and offer service to all areas of the county with your support. This is a proposal that is practical, makes good sense, and is very much needed by the citizens of Otter County.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Honorable Representatives, Madam Chair, my name is Jack Larson. I'm the Transit Director at Arrowhead Transit, operated by the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, which is a Minnesota Community Action Program. Arrowhead Transit operates in a 16,000 square service mile located in the Arrowhead region in the northeastern part of the state. We operate 55 accessible buses in the counties of Aiken, Carlton, Cook, Itasca, Coochiching, Lake, and St. Louis, excluding the city of Duluth. Arrowhead Transit provided 353,669 rides in calendar year 2004 in a rural and very rural service area. Arrowhead Transit is the largest public rural transit system in Minnesota and one of the largest in the nation. Honorable Representatives, in our area of the state, local transit service is critical for keeping people living and working in the region. Without public transportation, many people would not have a way to get to work, to access medical services, or to remain independently in their own homes. We've been operating on a limited budget for many years. We have always provided a local share to match state funds and keep our service operating, but at times it's been a struggle. We're working to achieve modest goals and want to ensure the residents of Greater Minnesota are not forgotten in the transit discussions. The funding for Greater Minnesota Transit continues to be a very small percentage of the state's overall budget. Yet transit budgets have been cut at the same time the demand for service is increasing. We've been impacted by recent budget reductions and cost increases, and a couple examples of rising health care costs and the sharply rising fuel costs. In addition to the cost increases, we've been informed by MnDOT that our motor vehicle sales tax funding will be decreased through the raw amount of revenue the state is receiving. So I urge you to consider the bill before you today as you work to develop a transportation funding package. We need increased dedicated revenue for transit systems throughout Minnesota. The Transportation Choices 2020 initiative provides for the real needs that exist for transit service expansion. It recognizes the need for an additional $60 million in revenue annually for Greater Minnesota, which would ensure that our needs are met. Thank you for your consideration on this proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Koiser. I'm the Executive Vice President for DARTS. DARTS is a 30-year-old operation that operates 35 specialized buses in Dakota County, Minnesota. Our service area extends from St. Paul to Northfield and from Hastings to Burnsville. We started a number of years ago, as you can tell, with four non-accessible vehicles, providing less than 2,000 rides a month, which has grown to 35 vehicles now, providing upwards of 15,000 rides per month to the most vulnerable and disabled population in the county. This is a dramatic increase and a trend that is not decreasing. Our county is growing and growing older as the secondary suburbs become grayer, like me, and exurban communities like Farmington and Lakeville have also grown. Our senior population alone in some areas will grow by over 300% by 2020, I should say. In 1993, DARTS became the ADA transit provider for the county, and with this change, we've seen a staggering growth in our ridership. Currently, 70% of our ridership is eligible for ADA service. This includes not only seniors, but adults with disabilities that need to go to work, as well as shopping and to medical appointments. These riders are able to keep their mobility by using DARTS, and in many cases, people have said they have moved to Dakota County because of DARTS. An example of one of our riders is Ethel, who we started transporting to a nursing home to visit her husband. Since her husband's death, she's become more physically disabled herself and is now going 3 days a week for dialysis treatment. Her son, Denny, is in the National Guard, and during his tours of duty, we were the link to her mobility and to her health. He said he felt more secure because organizations like DARTS was there. After last year's cuts, Ethel had to change her Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, 6 a.m. trips to dialysis to Monday, Wednesday, Friday because the weekend service in our community was cut. We've anticipated draconian-style cuts to the ADA service that are being proposed. A service that we are being informed of, service in Apple Valley could be cut altogether. Another example is a wheelchair-bound employee of Westbrook and Egan, who goes to work every day using our ADA service. The proposed cuts will eliminate his work trips to Eagan, and there are many other such stories for riders in Rosemont, River Grove Heights, as well as many other cities around the metropolitan area. These two examples clearly show the people who will be affected should the anticipated cuts in funding and the lack of investment, such as the transportation choices for 2020, will become real. And I want to stress this. So when Metro Transit and Minnesota Valley Transit Authority fixed routes are cut due to funding cuts, an even larger line of frail adults like EPA will be affected that I don't think the committee realizes. Over our history, DARTS has been recognized statewide and nationally as an innovator, collaborator, and resource in the community. We have coordinated with other providers to help maintain the community-based mobility assistance for the most vulnerable. We do so by creating a shared ride system and employing many different ways to utilize our resources efficiently and effectively. We've even created an award-winning social enterprise that was a national winner of a Yale Ventures Award to generate more revenue to help subsidize our agency, including our specialized transportation services. It is not a lack of coordination or innovation that's at issue. It is a recognition that mobility of the region is at risk, and the cuts proposed will be devastating to DARTS and will undermine the work that we've done to leverage state, county, local, and voluntary donations. Should our service be cut without the additional funding that could be proposed or could be part of the 2020 choices package, DART's reach in impact will be immediately felt by the growing communities such as Lakeville that Chair Holbrook is most familiar with. We had hoped to expand our leverage services in this part of the county, but that cannot happen when a significant portion of our budget could be cut. And there will be less flexibility that we've been known for to maximize the resources. The recognition of the domino effect of transit cuts needs to be increased. When cuts to transit affect the mobility of our seniors and others, they also become more vulnerable and enter an even more expensive system of health care living situations. Even more pressure is placed on the sons and daughters of these riders, who also have children to care for and who are also working more. This affects their productivity, their earnings, their taxpaying ability, and the fabric of the entire region and the state is at risk. In closing, after the press conference yesterday, a friend told me that I needed to smile more during these presentations. But as this process continues to underfund transit, my smile becomes less and less, and the same thing for us people we serve. So I hope you support this package, and we hope to get some fun. I can smile some more. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Munyon, if you want to bring your next set of testifiers on my list, I've got 7 people in about 11 minutes, so... Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record prior to your testimony, please.
My name is Ron Lloyd, President of the Amalgamated Transit Union. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm here not only to speak as a union leader, but also as a transit partner. I'm an advocate for this 2020 initiative for several reasons. Year after year, this and other bodies in the legislature have dealt blows to the transit budget. We get cut time after time, and it needs to stop. Transit is an integral part of the infrastructure of the Seven County metro area. Transit enables people to move all over the city in a safe and reliable manner. By cutting our budget year after year, we have had to cut jobs, reduce service, and raise fares. These three things all lead to a downward spiral for transit. This 2020 initiative would give us a plan on how to fund and make it work. It troubles me that the Met Council and most of the legislature have been talking for years that growing the system by the year 2020, but nobody acts on it. We cannot and should not wait until the 19th year to fund the 2020 plan. The time to act is now. It is imperative that we put this off no longer. This initiative speaks to the needs in the entire state, not just the metro area. This bill is not what do we want, but what the public needs. Metro Transit, in an effort to get in line with the upcoming budget shortfall, are in the process of setting up public hearings to enable them to cut service and reduce fares again. Also, ATU lost 15 mechanics positions right around Christmas. With new service cuts, we will lose more employees, which will have a direct effect on this local economy. Last year, it was a building a house to privatize Metro Transit. It failed. However, by cutting maintenance jobs, we don't have enough bodies to do the work, and Met Council outsources it. We as transit workers, along with the people that use transit daily, need the support of all legislators for our 2020 initiative. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lloyd.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alice Tibbetts. I am a resident of St. Paul, a parent, a taxpayer, and I walk and bicycle every day year-round. And yes, despite the lousy weather, I did ride my bike today. I'm also the chair of the St. Paul Bicycle Advisory Board, and I organized the state of Minnesota's first Safe Routes to School program. That program encourages families, schools, and traffic engineers to make it safer for children to walk and bike to school. And I learned from that experience how critical safe sidewalks and bikeways are to a vibrant community. I'm here to express my strong support of this bill for four reasons. First, every person in this room is a pedestrian, and every transit trip ends and starts either on foot or by bicycle. A complete system of sidewalks, bike paths, and on-street bike lanes make our transit system more efficient and encourages far more people to use transit. Second, connecting bicycling with transit allows people like me and thousands of others to travel throughout the metro area without needing to drive. I'm very lucky I have great connections from my home in St. Paul, but I'm one of the few. I have the opportunity to bike for 6 blocks through an express bus to downtown St. Paul or Minneapolis, and then to bicycle either west to Minnetonka or east all the way to Stillwater on dedicated bike paths. The bike-bus connection allows me to navigate my entire community. But I am lucky because I have that and most people don't. Think of how easy it would be for other metro residents if we had those kinds of connections. Third, this bill would really help our suburban communities pay for biking and walking projects. These projects have been funded by federal dollars that have rewarded high-density cities and put suburban communities at a disadvantage. This new state money could help them plan, design, and leverage new funds to build projects to make it easier and safer for people in our suburban areas to get from home to work to church and to transit. And finally, and most importantly, I am the parent of two teenagers who are not mature enough to drive. They walk, they bike, and they take the bus. They are independent, and I am happy because I do not spend my life driving my children from place to place. And believe me, this is a major quality of life issue. On one of the days my son and I did have to drive, Patrick and I got stuck in rush hour traffic. And I told him, I have a wish for your future, and it is that you get to your job without sitting in a car for hours every day. And my son looked at me and he said, Mom, if this will be my life, I'll just live at home with you and skip the job. I strongly urge you to support this bill for the future of our communities, our children, and our loved ones. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairwoman, committee members, my name is Trudy Kretzinger. I reside in Blaine and attend Luther Seminary in St. Paul. I became involved with Isaiah while serving as an intern pastor with 3 St. Paul congregations of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Isaiah is an interfaith group of 81 congregations in the Twin Cities and St. Cloud. We are called by our faith to act in public, to eliminate the systemic economic and racial inequities. Our vision is one of people acting in community with hope and shared abundance. Part of this is making sure that our state builds a transportation system that works for all of us, including those who, for various reasons, are unable to drive. Most of the businesses in the neighborhoods around the congregations I serve were very small businesses, bars, restaurants, convenience stores. There were very few opportunities for people living in those neighborhoods to have good jobs with livable wages in walking distance of their homes. If they are to find good paying jobs, they must be able to travel to other areas of the metro. For example, one neighborhood resident was qualified for a position with Best Buy headquarters in Bloomington. However, because she was dependent on mass transportation, the system in its current form could not support her commute, and she had to refuse the offer. I live in Blaine, and I can commute to and from St. Paul because I have my own vehicle. But this woman in St. Paul could not do the same. This is not fair. The transportation system assumes that, by and large, residents have access to their own personal vehicles. Meanwhile, those who lack the qualifications to drive, those who lack the skills to operate motor vehicles, and those who lack the money to purchase and maintain those vehicles are marginalized in our community. This simply is not fair, and it is not just. We know what fair is. Everyone gets a piece. Everyone gets a turn. Everyone gets a chance. For people of faith, Scripture tells us what justice is. Verse after verse states that to establish justice, we must give particular attention to those at the margins of community, the vulnerable people, the widows, the orphans, the poor. The New Testament writer James tells us that it is hypocrisy to wish that those in need be well-fed, clothed, and warm if the ones doing the well-wishing withhold those things that are needed to be fed and clothed and warm. Because of our disjointed transit system, people are being kept at the margins of our communities. To keep them at the margins is to say that there is simply not enough for all of us, that some of us will have to do without. This is a lie. When we pool our resources together, we make an investment in our common future. We invite everyone to share in the opportunities to live and work in different parts of our community. This strengthens our community as a whole. Isaiah supports the Transit Choices 2020 initiative as the proposal that provides stable and adequate funding needed to offer all Minnesotans real transportation choices. We ask you, our elected representatives, to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bunyan, we've got 3 minutes and 4 testifiers, so I don't know how you want to handle this. And some members of the audience may wonder why we're so tight on our time frame. We had this time frame for every transportation funding proposal that came before the committee, and so we're trying to treat each proposal fairly. President Hausman.
I just might observe, however, Madam Chair, that maybe the others had a little more of their tilt toward roads and highways as opposed to this one, which focuses just on transit. So I would argue we give them a little bit of leeway here.
And Representative Hausman, that would be great, except we have an additional 5 bills on the calendar in addition to this item. So welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairwoman and committee members, my name is Bob Belmick. I'm from St. Cloud. I belong to the Great River Interfaith Partnership, which is part of Isaiah. I'm here today to share a letter from a St. Cloud resident who wants to be heard, but is fearful of testifying publicly because she left an abusive relationship. Before I share this woman's story, I'd just like to share a little bit of my own story with mass transportation. I, too, use the bus in St. Cloud. It's the way I got to work. In this woman's story, we came to St. Cloud in December of 1997. My family and I stayed in a battered woman's shelter for 2 months. We had come there to escape domestic violence. I didn't have a job, I didn't know how to drive a car, and I knew very little about St. Cloud. The main reason I chose St. Cloud was because it had a bus system and taxi cabs. The place I'd come from did not. The bus system was a blessing, but it wasn't perfect. With 2 children, ages 11 and 13, I often found myself trying to figure out what bus to take so I could get to a school function on time, not an hour early or an hour late. I worked as a receptionist at a downtown office on a good bus route. However, several times, I went to a teacher's conference over my lunch hour, hoping I'd have time to catch a bus back to work afterwards. Usually, I'd find myself walking the mile or so back to work because I had missed the bus. On one occasion, my son was hurt at school and had to be taken to the emergency room. I wanted to rush to the hospital to be with him, but there wasn't a bus leaving downtown for half an hour, so I had to wait. That was one of the worst experiences of my life. Another was when my mother, who was 70 at the time, was in the hospital. The doctors weren't sure what was wrong, and I knew that my being there made her feel better. But because of the limited bus service, I could only visit for an hour a day on weeknights, and an hour on Saturday. At that time, there was no Sunday bus service. Limited bus service was eventually started on Sundays, but a trip had to be scheduled in advance, and the space and time requested were not always available. Because of the limitations of bus service, I've learned to live on a schedule, carefully plotting each trip I make to be sure I get there and get home. By Friday evenings and Saturdays, I used up running errands. Most of my time is spent standing at the bus stop waiting for the bus. I've tried to attend church on Sundays, but with bus service as it is not always possible. I don't make plans that involve going anywhere on holidays because there is no bus service, which means no church on Christmas Day, and bus service on Christmas Eve ends at 5 p.m. I'm thankful for what I have, but it could definitely be better. And thank you for the opportunity of sharing this woman's story.
Thank you very much.
I'm just going to introduce myself. I'm Donna Peterson. I was here with Friendship for Livable Communities, but I think in honor of the time, we should move on.
All right. Thank you very much for coming, and we're sorry that we didn't have time. All right. I understand that. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Judy Sanders. I'm here with the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, and we are here. You see us every year at the beginning of the legislative session. We bring to you our agenda. This year, we have put public transit on it because we believe that public transit is good for everybody. We are impressed with the idea of 2020. Usually people are talking about visual acuity when they say that. So we feel right at home. And we also are giving you a challenge. People have talked to you. It's obvious that, of course, we need bus service or we can't go anywhere. You already know that. And sometimes you care and sometimes you don't. We're asking you to think outside the car, not just for us, but for you. Make it possible for blind people to move to those seven counties that don't have public transit. Make it possible for there to be less cars on the road. Join us on the bus and on the bike paths, and it's a win-win situation for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming down today. Members of the audience, we appreciate all of you taking the time to come down today. You have two great representatives, And Ms. Munyon and Ms. Thaman working the bill. Members of the committee will have the opportunity to speak to them later on. And we're going to move on to our next agenda item, which is House File 310.
Could we just ask Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, who their last person would have represented that last testimony?
Marty Gates from the Senior Federation was the only member that was on my list that wasn't able to testify. I saw Representative Bernardi in the room. She's going against the tide, I would assume. I know. And members, we have, I think, three bills that we've heard without a House file number. We should have House file numbers for all the transportation proposals next week, so we'll procedurally deal with that. And many of them, because they have election issues, will likely be referred to the Civil Law and Elections Committee to be heard in that committee and then come back for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is Representative Bernardi in the room? Is Don Hagman in the room? Mr. Hagman, if you'd step to the podium, I'd like to get started here. My understanding is you're the Director of Real Estate for Medtronic. If you'd like to share your testimony with the committee at this time, I would appreciate it. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Don Hagman. I'm Director of Real Estate and Construction at Medtronic. On behalf of my company, I want to thank you today for your time.
Excuse me for just a minute. Members of the audience, if you could hold your conversation until you get out in the hallway, we'd really appreciate being able to continue our business. Thank you very much. If you'd continue, Mr. Hagman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank you for your time today as well as your ongoing service to the state of Minnesota. The reason we're here today is very simple. We're growing jobs in Minnesota faster than we can house them. On average, almost 300 a year. If we continue to grow jobs here, we need a long-term solution. Let me share with you a bit of historical perspective on this subject. And in fact, I think there's some handouts coming across that has some of this data correct. In 1999, Medtronic made a decision to construct our 460,000-square-foot world headquarters facility in Fridley. At that time, we indicated that this need was driven by our desire to add 1,000 new jobs in the Twin Cities. Our extra toll over that time frame was close to 2,000, almost double those projections. This new proposed project and Solution would become our world headquarters for our cardiac rhythm management division, which is our largest business unit. They're the people who make the cardiac implantable pacemakers. Initially, we planned to build an 820,000 square foot facility, which in itself would be the single largest building Medtronic has anywhere in the world, and the largest project of its kind in our history by a factor of almost two. The site will be master planned to provide a potential of 1.5 million square feet for long-term growth opportunities. Last year, we worked closely with a local economist from Minnesota who analyzed the economic impact of Medtronic on the state. Several of the highlights are, of our 33,000 employees worldwide, 6,800 are in Minnesota. Our current direct spend contributes $1 billion per year to the state economy. In fact, I didn't bring it up with me. In my briefcase, I have a 59-page document that shows that we do business with 3,400 businesses in the state of Minnesota. That was last year. Our average salary in the state is $70,200 per year plus benefits. Going forward, our proposed project would potentially provide 2,000 new high-paying jobs in Minnesota by 2012, a 31% increase over our existing employment. The project construction costs and equipment purchases over a four-year period of this project and subsequent facility upgrades of some of our current facilities will drive investment activity over $250,000 with an average of 250 direct construction-type jobs. The macro-level economic impact of this expansion on the state would result in $495 million annually and 4,300 full-time jobs when it's all fully developed. In closing, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I hope my enthusiasm for this opportunity to grow world-class jobs and world-class benefits in Minnesota is shared by all of you, and is shared as it is shared by Anoka and Ramsey County, Moundsview, Blaine, and Shoreview, with which we are currently closely working. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hagman, and I appreciate you bearing with us with some of the confusion earlier. Welcome to the committee, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know if this gentleman was your first testifier or not, but he was ready and available, so I put him to
that
work.
That was good. Yes, Madam Chair, it's hard to get through the traffic when you're good.
We saw it with your small stature. We thought you were going to be have quite a trip to get up to the stand, so we decided to start. I've left about a total of 25 minutes for this bill hearing. We have two testifiers for MnDOT. I don't know how you want to structure about 5 to 10 minutes of additional testimony for your testifiers, but certainly if you'd let us know, we'll move forward.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have at least 10 more minutes of testimony, and Aaron Backman, I'd like him to come up. Can we pull up a chair? Okay, right. Okay, so, Madam Chair, I'd like just to do my testimony real quick here for you, if you don't mind. Thank you, members, for having us here today. This is, Don Hagman mentioned $250,000 of investment. It's actually $250 million worth of investment, just to let you know. Our companion bill is on the floor in the Senate. We have the amendment before you today that was brought before policy, and then as Madam Chair, you probably either you already talked about it or you'll go into more detail what our plans are on Tuesday. But this is one of the most important economic development packages in recent history. It's exactly the types of jobs that we want to create in Minnesota. It's not just the numbers or the quality of jobs, it's also the industry that we want to help promote. And these are the jobs that we, as I said, that we want to keep in Minnesota. Before I move on to our next testifiers, I would just like to thank the City of Moundsview, Blaine, Shoreview, Anoka County, Ramsey County, Commissioner Kramer, Commissioner Malno, MnDOT, Margaret Amundson, and Chair Earhart, and now our committee administrator, Becky Gerbna, and Chair Mary Liz Holberg for helping figure out a solution in which to move this forward, as well as Governor Plenty and his office. This is a big project and takes a lot of people and a lot of support from people, so I welcome your questions and hope can get a lot of those answers today. And then with us today is our City Council Member Roger Stigney, as well as Aaron Backman, our development Economic Development Director in Mount View.
Thank you, Representative Verdardi. And for members, we don't have an amendment in front of you. We have the first engrossment. The bill was amended in transportation policy, so the copy of the bill that's in front of you is the first engrossment and reflects the amendment that was made in policy. And today, certainly, we all recognize the importance of fostering development of good jobs in Minnesota, but the main issue before this committee today is the assets of the Trunk Highway Fund, the policies related to that, and MnDOT, and so if we can concentrate our discussion on those particular issues, we'd appreciate that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair Holberg and members of the House Finance Transportation Committee. My name is Roger Stigney. I'm a council member in the city of Moundsville. I also serve as the vice president of the Moundsville Economic Development Authority. Today I'm filling in for our mayor, Rob Marty, who couldn't be here today. So I'm going to just make a couple of brief comments on my own behalf and also for what I view that I see of the city and the council members. First of all, I come to you as an elected official, as I said, as a council member and also a 40-year resident of Moundsville, and also an owner of a small business in Moundsville Electronics Company. I know firsthand my experience on the council of what it is to provide quality services on a limited tax base, and that's what we're experiencing now in Moundsville, with, especially with LGA cuts and so forth, and the governor's asked the cities to try to come up with means to iron out those disparities on our own, and that's what we're doing with the Medtronics project, looking at it very seriously to help boost our tax base. As you may or may not know, Moundsville is a small community, about 12,800 residents, and it's within 4 square miles in the northwest corner of Ramsey County. Historically, we have had a much higher residential tax base than commercial, and so what we're trying to do is try to avert the double-digit tax levies increases in the city that we've had to incur in the last couple of years. So we don't want those to reoccur, and we're looking at Medtronic project as a possible alternative to that. And as it's been stated, the Medtronic project represents the single largest business development opportunity in the city's history, and we'd like to move forward with it. The first phase, as they said, would cover about 3,000 high-paying jobs and result in an investment of over $65 million in our community. It'll eliminate a money-losing operation of the city, which is our municipal golf course that is now in debt by over $4 million, and we cannot just continue to support that the way it's going, so we're looking at alternatives to that. The benefits of this development will clearly go beyond the boundaries of our cities, as you're well aware. Moundsville City Council is very supportive of passage of this measure, and as well as the Economic Development Commission and our staff. So far, we committed over $125,000 in local funds to support this effort, and would like to continue with it. So this legislation is really necessary to allow this corporate campus to come in to Moundsville. So in summary, I'd just like to ask your consideration for passage of this bill to remove the reverter clause so we can proceed and try to bring Medtronic into Moundsville. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Stigney, absent this money from Medtronic, how would the city of Moundsville pay back the $4.1 million in debt associated with the golf course project?
We would really be scratching. I don't know how. We can't get a casino there, I don't believe. But we have a severe problem on money shortage, and we need to do something in the way of development. And this opportunity came along, and I think we have to explore it to the fullest.
But certainly, as a council member, if you're sitting on $4.1 million in debt, you must have explored some options besides this in taking care of that problem.
Well, we are looking towards some things in the future here. Our economic development coordinator here can probably comment further in detail on that.
Yeah. And I'm assuming you must be Mr. Backman?
Yes.
Welcome correct. To the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, and members of the committee, my name is Aaron Backman. I'm the Economic Development Coordinator for the City of Moundsville. In answer to your question, Madam Chair, one of the options that the city looked at was putting up billboard signs, and that was a lengthy process. And they have been under construction. In fact, the leases that were issued for that occurred prior to our working with Medtronic. If we had known at the time that we were working with Medtronic, we would have not signed those leases.
And if I might, the length of the leases and the revenue to the city, the terms of that? And then what happens if the Medtronic process goes forward?
Right. Medtronic has indicated that they do not wish to have the signs adjacent to their corporate buildings, and so we would be looking at trying to remove those billboards that just were put in. In terms of the lease terms, they are 20-year leases, so a fairly substantial length of time with Clear Channel. We would receive in the future, we haven't received it yet, but we would receive a portion of those revenues that is listed currently at 50% of the revenue base, which amounts to about $240,000 a year, approximately.
And if I might, how many billboards?
Six.
And when you went into that contract, was there any question about billboards being not part of a quote-unquote public use of that property when discussions with MnDOT?
Yes, there was a question.
And what was there any, did MnDOT, I mean, was MnDOT, did they sign off on leasing billboards as being a public use of their property? Were they a party to that contract, or was it done without their blessing, if you will?
To answer those questions, I would defer to other folks on that. Kurt might want to respond to that. That actually occurred prior to my advent at the city.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kurt Ulrich. I'm Mauser City Administrator. Could you repeat the question, please?
My question is that my understanding is that the agreement tendered between MnDOT and the City of Moundsview for the use of this land was all centered around the use of the land being for a public purpose, and that being, from what I understand, a fairly strictly adhered to standard with assets of MnDOT. And so I'm wondering, when a city goes in and tenders an agreement to make money on billboards, how that fits into the definition of public purpose of that land, and if before you entered into that contract, if there was any discussions with MnDOT as far as that contract went.
I did come to the city in 2003, but my understanding was a public purpose issue was addressed, and it was considered that the signs were incidental to the golf course use, that revenue coming in via the golf course was considered incidental, and so the public, it wasn't considered a separate business. It was considered part of the golf course and green space of that property, much like rental golf carts or the revenue coming off the golf course. It was incidental revenue to the operation of the golf course, and so that therefore was considered part of the public purpose, and so that issue was addressed that way. MnDOT did issue the permits. It's a permitting process that has to be approved by MnDOT, and those permits were approved.
Okay, thank you. Was there any additional testimony that we skipped with the Moundsview people quickly before we move on to MnDOT?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron Backman has some testimony.
And again, if you'll confine your comments to the issue before this committee, which is the value of the land, giving up the right to the public purpose of that land, and the compensation for the value of that land.
In terms of history, and I won't go over all the comments that are in the attachment that I have distributed, but a couple of things that I would like to uplift. Back in 1988, and you have a map that's attached in the back portion of that handout. Back in 1988, the City of Moundsview was able to acquire title to 52.4 acres of excess lands that were originally taken by the state of Minnesota for the State Highway 10 construction project. Approximately 40.4 acres is located north of State Highway 10. During the second half of 2004, Medtronic began working with the city regarding the redevelopment of the property for proposed corporate office campus. Medtronic is interested in acquiring the whole golf course property, including the former MnDOT property. Medtronic will pay a fair market value. The former MnDOT property, shown in transparent orange and purple, is bisected by a large wetland. So, again, as a reference point, everything that would be sold to Medtronic is either the transparent yellow or the transparent orange. The transparent orange refers to the former MnDOT property. And you, in the middle, you see a fairly large area in purple that is the wetland. The wetland.
Sir, do we have a price of settled on the fair market value of the MnDOT portion of the site?
We've been having ongoing discussions or negotiations between Medtronic and ourselves, and at this point it would be between our two appraisals. Their appraisal was 7.7, our appraisal was at 10, and we're in approximately $8.5 million for the total 72 acres.
And if I might, was there a second appraisal or as part of this appraisal where the 12 acres south of the freeway appraised as well, given that was initially part of the consideration?
There was no appraisal of the land to the south of 10.
Okay. Thanks.
The point I'm trying to make in terms of the wetland, there's the wetland that makes up about a third of the former MnDOT property basically bisects, separates the land there and makes redevelopment of that whole area challenging. The development of the campus facilities will be primarily in the middle, about where the words are that you see proposed site of Medtronic campus. That's approximately where the buildings would go. Medtronic wishes to buy the whole site, but the development of the eastern portion is difficult because of the wetland. So in essence, about two-thirds or three-quarters of the former MnDOT property is in essence not developable.
Okay. Are you done with your testimony?
Yes.
Are there any questions from the folks from Mountie at this time? Otherwise, we'll move on to the testimony by MnDOT. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
On my list, I have Mr. Pink and Mr. Popko from MnDOT to provide information on the parcel in consideration and a little bit of the history of MnDOT land donations in general. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen. You'll state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Al Pint. I'm the Director of the Office of Land Management with MnDOT. And with me is Frank Papko, the Area Manager with MnDOT for the area, including Mounds View. I think we've been asked to come to this committee to present two things. One is kind of how we handle reconveyances and historically what we've done with reconveyances. And I've provided that in a memo dated March 10th from Mike Stensberg. I hope everybody's got that memo.
And members, that is in your committee packet for today.
With the accompanying two tables and the flow chart.
Yep, we're all here on the same page.
So I will cover the history of our reconveyances in the state and a little bit about our policy on reconveyances. And then Frank is here to answer questions that you may have on the details of the acquisition and proposed reconveyance of the property in Moundsview that now has the Bridges Golf Course. Why don't I direct your attention right to Table 1.
All right.
Which I've included the reconveyed parcels from 1990 through 2004. I've broken that down into essentially three different types of reconveyances. The first is for public purpose for $0. The second is for sale to public agencies for money. And the third is to private individuals for money. Generally, when we've been asked or we convey property to public agencies for $0, it's with the stated purpose of a public purpose. When we do that, we ask that there be a reversionary clause in the deed such that if the public agency then wants to do something else with that property other than use it for a public purpose, there's a cloud on that title so that it's a little tougher for somebody to use it for a non-public purpose.
You can see that over the 15-year period, we transferred 294 parcels of land to public agencies for public purposes for $0. Then on the next page, I just broke that down into what types of public agencies we transfer that property to for $0. You can see the majority is to cities. 174 of those reconveyances went to cities. And then the next one would probably be school districts, 50 parcels. Those are the $0 reconveyances. But that's a small part of our reconveyances. I then wanted to look at the remaining reconveyances where we got what we determined to be fair market value for the land. I broke that down into sales to public agencies, again, cities, counties, school districts, other state agencies, although generally we just do a transfer of custodial control to other state agencies. But you can see in the last 15 years, 448 of those 1,754 parcels reconveyed were reconveyed to public agencies for the fair market value of that property. Jumping over a couple of columns, you can see money received public. That's the money that we received based on the fair market value of those parcels. The other money we received is the money received from the sale of properties to private individuals. The sum of those two then is the total amount that we took in for the state in the last 15 years, that being about $28 million worth of property. You can see over the last few years, we've had a little more of a concentrated effort on selling some of the larger parcels of property that we have. For instance, in 2004, over $5 million worth of property was sold to private and public agencies at fair market value. So that gives you an idea on the quantity and the amount of money that we bring back into the Trunk Highway Fund as we sell these properties. Then there's always an issue if we bought the property with federal dollars, there's a transaction that takes place that credits us with a reimbursement for the federal dollars, although the money doesn't go, it stays in the Trunk Highway Fund, but we get credit as a reimbursement. Again, for a total of $28 million over the last 15 years.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Pinth for the general information about reconveyances of MnDOT assets?
Madam Chair.
Representative Larson.
Well, just a brief question as it relates to some degree of monitoring situations where MnDOT has a reverter clause on property, public properties. Is there some method of keeping an eye on those that those agencies haven't also been using them for private purposes? We heard some description earlier about some negotiations that I'm still not sure if MnDOT was in on it or not. As it relates to the billboards, what's MnDOT's practice in this area?
Mr. Pent.
Madam Chair, Representative Larson, I'd like to say that we monitor these for the life of that property, but we don't. We don't have the resources to do that, and that's the reason that some time ago, and I'm not exactly sure how long ago, we went to that reverter clause, so that we didn't have to monitor what's happening to the property. You know, we may sell a few small parcels to a city who will assemble them and sometimes use them for public purposes, other times turn around and resell them. I think on many occasions we've transferred title to the city with the reverter clause only to have them come back and say, will you determine fair market value? We need to get rid of that reverter clause. And then we do that. We'll turn around and get the property appraised, take the reverter clause off, and sell the property to the city because now there's a developer that wants to buy it from the city. That's not unusual at all.
Thank you. Any additional questions? All right. Now we're going to talk about the specific parcel, I believe. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frank Papko. I'm the North Area Manager for our Metro District, which includes Ramsey County in this parcel. tend to give you a history of this parcel. Back in 1964, there was a parcel of land, roughly an 80, but since there never is an 80, it was 77.73 acres. And it was needed for the intersection of Future Highway 10 and Interstate 35W. There was 22.82 acres of that land was needed for right-of-way, and the remainder of right-of-way that would go down the center of that 80. It was purchased in 1964 for $143,339. There were 22.82 acres of right-of-way and 54.91 acres of excess. The landowner chose to have us do a total take. Federal funds were used in that purchase. There were they specifically purchased 12.86 acres of the right-of-way needed for the highway on the eastern side as it abuts 35W, and they also paid a lesser amount for the severance damages to the remaining excess. That money was parlayed into a total take by our MnDOT right-of-way staff at that time. The federal dollars constituted 64% of the total purchase price. And then it gets a little more complicated because since we had the entire parcel, our designers decided to shift the alignment a little bit to the south. And so in part, what had been right-of-way became excess, and what had been excess became right-of-way. It increased the size of the land to the north, and it remained until 1988 when a state law told MnDOT to sell the land to the city of Mounds View at $0. And we had the and the law also had the reverter clause in it. What happened in there is there's 41.81 acres that by our calculations in the parcel that is going to be part of the Medtronic purchase. Somewhere between one half of an acre and 1 acre of that particular land was the specific land that was bought with federal dollars for right-of-way. We have contacted Federal Highway Administration staff, and their initial position is that they want their money back. But exactly how much is it worth and for what land exactly they still have under review for the reasons I talked about, the how the right-of-way shifted and does severance damages include. I would say the range of possible federal interest in the land is on the high side 64% of the total price, or on the other side 0.5 to 1 acre of the parcel. And according to the current site plan we have for the Mounds View development, it would be located in a corner that is currently slated for wetland mitigation ponding area and not building site. The controlling authority for the federal position requirement for your attorney's purposes is found in 23 CFR 710.403B, which requires essentially fair market value to be returned for the land. FHWA can grant an exception, which is how we can do these $0 reconveyances for public purposes, and it is for social, environmental, or economic reasons. And they immediately clarified the economic reasons and said they limit their economic reasons to that involving low-income, environmental justice-type issues, of which they would not consider Medtronic to qualify. You have asked about the value of the land. We have not done an appraisal upon the parcel. However, our staff has, just for planning purposes, put an estimate of $3 to $5 a square foot. $4 a square foot constitutes $7.3 million for the 41.47 acres, which is well in line with the testimony of Mounds View, which had, I believe, a little 8.4 acres of their estimated market value, slightly over $4 a square foot.
All right, thank you. That's a nice history of that particular piece of property. Are there any questions at this time? Can you tell me this review or exception process with the federal highway group, what's the timeline for that? Is there an expedited process? I mean, it seems that we probably have to look at resolving that issue as well. It's not just a simple MnDOT issue.
There is no process and rule other than we need Federal Highway Administration approval. We would need to apply to them in writing. They would need to respond to us in writing.
And from your experience, how long would something like this generally take?
I have never gone through that.
Lovely. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and Mr. Pascoe, does that go beyond the Region 5 feds, you have to go to D.C.?
My understanding is that review can occur in the division office here in St. Paul.
That makes it good.
All right, thank you. Representative Abrams.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to understand this. Even if it was what could be called a friends and family transfer, the federal government can ask for their proportion of fair market value, not the amount of dollars that were actually received. Am I correct in that assumption?
Mr. Pence.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that to be correct, that they can and would ask for their share of the fair market value of that property. It always comes down to negotiation then of what property they contributed in and what their share of the fair market value of that property is.
And Madam Chair, just a brief follow-up. Who would have to pay? If let's say there was just a friends and family transfer and the federal government said, hypothetically, we want two-thirds of $7.7 million, who's going to have to come up with those dollars? Would it be MnDOT or would it be Medtronic? Would it be the city of Moundsview? Who would have to come up with the money?
Mr. Pant.
Madam Chair, I think if I understand the question, if there's money that we receive for that property, we would have to pay for that property.
Well, Madam Chair, that begs the question. What if you receive zero? What would the federal government then say?
Mr. Pant.
I don't know, Madam Chair, Representative Abrams. I'm not aware of any condition where we should have gotten money for land and didn't, and I don't know what position the Federal Highway Administration would take as it relates to the reimbursement of that money. However, keep in mind that this is not money that we really give to the Federal Highway Administration. We get credit for a reimbursement, but then they say you can use that money, however, on other federally eligible transportation projects. So it's not like anybody pays. I don't know if I was clear when I mentioned that on the federal reimbursement, that it's not really we give money back. We get credit for a reimbursement, but it stays in the Trunk Highway Fund for use on other federally eligible transportation projects.
Thank you. Any additional questions? All right. Representative Bernardi.
Madam Chair, my testifiers would like to comment about the land value that was mentioned. Would that be all right?
Certainly.
Okay.
Now we're going to wrap it up. We won't vote on this issue today. We have four additional bills to do in 15 minutes. And so we'll take some follow-up comments here, and then we'll lay the bill on the table and continue to work with all the interested parties to see if we can work out some kind of agreement that protects the interests of the Trunk Highway Fund, meets the needs of the city of Moundsview, and also meets the needs of Medtronic Corporation. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our city manager as well as Medtronic representative would like to make a comment.
All right, great. Thank you. Who wants to go first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to comment on the land value. When Mr. Pafko from MnDOT mentioned that in their view it was worth $4 a square foot, that's $7.2 million, he compared it to the appraisal for the entire 70 acres, and that, as Mr. Backman had indicated, was a range that we had for our appraisals for the entire site of $7.7 to $10 million, somewhere in that range. And so if you look at just the 40 acres, it's about 55% of that, which the market value range would be $4.2 to $5.5 million if you base it just on square footage value. And I believe In our opinion, the land on the eastern side with the wetland area and the land that would not support the Medtronic buildings is of a lesser value than that value overall.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Hagman.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Medtronic has about 275 facilities throughout the world, 12 of which are in Minnesota. And part of my job responsibility is to buy land and construct facilities, and I've done that in Europe, Asia, Mexico, throughout the United States. And in my opinion, the price that we're negotiating currently with Mounds View is very fair. And going forward, I was a bit surprised with the Mr. Papko's testimony on the suggestion that the value of the land is at $3.50 a square foot.
I think his testimony was somewhere between $3 and $5 per foot, and that he used the example of $4 per foot for the dollar amount that he presented to the committee.
Madam Chair, I apologize for for the average of $4 a square foot. One price point based for a comparable MnDOT land sale of 23 acres that happened several years ago, just a stone's throw from this site over in Shoreview. And that transaction appraisal was done, and it suggested the fully developable land was valued at about $17,500 an acre. And the transaction was completed for a portion of that sale with the city of Shoreview. So based on that comparable, which was just a few years ago, the suggestion is that it would be substantially lower than the value that was earlier quoted.
Right, thank you. And I mean, there's going to be experts that are going to have to determine the land value, but I think we've raised a number of issues today with the value of the property, the issue with the federal highway administration, a possible interest in this. We're not going to resolve this today. I've committed to Representative Bernardi and to the administration to continue to work to some kind of resolution that we can meet the needs of Medtronic. I do have one additional question. In your site plan, do you envision using this portion of the property at all?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, at this point, as Mr. Beckman had indicated earlier, the first phase and subsequent phases are more to the west, for example, on the other side of the wetland. So at this point, it's highly unlikely that we would use the wetland as well as the land that's to the east of that.
And then one additional question. I was told by a member of the administration that it was your intent to leave the wetland area accessible to the public. Is that true?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have a lot of privacy issues related to patents, and with our the amount of information that we have, it's a policy of ours to not open up our sites for public access. I'm sure that's not any different than 3M or Best Buy or some of the other large corporations in Minnesota.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to point out there's a large wetland area to the west there, and that area would remain open to the public. In fact, it's the city's intention that land would be developed with some trails and a small parking lot, so that would have public access.
Right.
And that would be the former Cisco property.
And that's great, and I'm particularly concerned with the MnDOT property, and if there's some way that we can reduce the amount of property that would be taken out of a public use to try and tender some type of resolution of this issue. So thank you very much. Hopefully we'll be back on Tuesday for some type of resolution on this, and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you very much. The next bill on the agenda is actually Representative Anderson, but in the interest of how much you care about Representative Vandeveer, we're going to let him go ahead of you. He's been waiting patiently, and as a member of the committee, you're not going anywhere for a while. So we're going to move these bills rather rapidly. They all have fiscal notes, so they will all be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus transportation finance bill. Representative Vandeveer, I will move House File 883 for consideration by the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there is the 883-882 amendment, which we could go through the bill, I guess, real quickly if you'd want to do that first. But it's just some clarifying language as to how it's determined who qualifies for PLATE.
Right, and let's move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss it. Members, are there any questions on the A2 amendment? It just has a certification process to be qualified for the plates. All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Vandeveer, if you want to pay particular attention to the fiscal portion of your bill, as that is what's before this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I didn't pick up the fiscal portion. I didn't see it up there. Is there?
Representative Vandeveer, it shows a $3,000 cost to the Highway User Tax Distribution
Fund, Madam Chair, fiscal year
06.
Yes, and I have discussed this with the disabled vets group that proposed the legislation, and they had indicated that they would be willing to raise that amount of money prior to the plates being printed.
All right, and if you would like your testifier to testify briefly.
Certainly. There is a correction to the amendment that should be made real quickly. If someone could move it on line 7, delete and total. I think that has a different meaning than what we intend.
I'll incorporate that into my motion for
thank
the you. A2 amendment.
Okay, so to the witness.
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Edmund Erdos. That's E-R-D-O-S. Madam Chair, members of this committee and guests, my name is Edmund Erdos. I am a service-connected disabled American veteran of the United States Marine Corps of almost 14 years of honorable and faithful service to this great country of ours. I served from 79 to 93. I'm also a life member of Disabled American Veterans, member of the American Legion, VFW, and a few others. Some which I can't even remember, I just pay the dues. Nonetheless, as you can see, I have a full plate. Today I work for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs at the Regional Office of Fort Snelling as a field examiner. Although I mentioned to you earlier that I was disabled, you probably couldn't tell just by looking at me, but I am. In my present position, I monitor our disabled veterans, their widows, and their minor or helpless adult children. More specifically, I work with those who are incapacitated mentally or physically to a degree that renders them incapable of managing their VA benefit. Essentially, I help those who are unable to help themselves with regards to the proper administration of various VA benefits they have so rightfully earned and deserve and may be entitled to. Having said this, you can see I have a special place in my heart for our veterans and their spouses and children. I come before you today not as an organizational member of the Disabled American Veterans or any other veteran service organization, but as a disabled American veteran, speaking on behalf of all disabled American veterans within our state. These veterans were subjected to a misfortune that has caused them to become disabled by reason of injury or illness while serving a period of active duty or active duty for training in the armed forces of the United States. Our veterans have wholeheartedly dedicated themselves to the service of this great nation of ours, some during conflict and some during peacetime, but all in the defense of our country. Unfortunately, many have not returned home to be with their loved ones. Countless others have returned with physical and mental scars. Everyone suffers when we have losses such as those I have just described. But none of us can bear the thought of wondering how disabled veterans suffers and tries to readjust to a sense of normalcy upon returning home. All too often we look away, sometimes in shame, sometimes in pity. They deserve much more than our country has ever given them. They have made the ultimate sacrifice by either giving their life or having suffered a permanent disability as a result of their faithful service. What a price. Currently, our state offers special motor vehicle license plates to veterans of World War I, World War II, Vietnam, the Korean War, the Gulf War, Laos War. We offer plates to our Pearl Harbor survivors, and there's a few others. These plates were all designed and created as mere tokens to display our vehicles to show everyone how proudly we serve that country. Unfortunately, when I reviewed the list of veterans' license plates our state has to offer for our veterans, nowhere was I able to find any plates that would represent our disabled veterans. I know many other states have them, but I can't understand why our state doesn't.
Sir, and I'm sorry, the majority of the members that are on this committee were on transportation policy and heard your testimony in that committee. We mainly deal with the fiscal issues.
I'm
not trying to be rude by any means. I know you've been here for the whole committee waiting for this, and we have another bill that also has testifiers up, and we have to conclude by 2:15.
So, Madam Chair, if I could close.
Certainly.
There is no disabled Americans vet plate,
right.
And I think it's a very reasonable request, and I think it would be good to honor our disabled vets in the way that they have asked for and allow them to have this plate. Now, I know we can talk about this to hopefully another time, but I think with that we'll just close.
All right. Thank you. And, sir, I'm sorry. I mean, we didn't have more time for you. And with that, I will lay House File 883 on the table for possible inclusion in the transportation finance omnibus bill. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Representative Anderson, you're up next, and we sent Representatives Dorman and Nelson. That was House File 105 and House File 1095. We will not be able to get to them today. We will hear those bills on Tuesday. Representative Anderson, and again, I know that you have some people here to testify, but this the majority of this committee heard these issues in the policy committee as well. Welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 171 to be included for possible inclusion in the omnibus transportation finance bill. And the bill before you, members, and lots of you have heard this already because of policy and being in state government finance, other things. It's basically to bring a bill, a license plate for veterans who've served in the Iraq War, Afghanistan War, or a theater that deals with global war on terrorism. And as you see before you on the screen, there's some pictures of the members who've served overseas from the unit here, in the especially from the Delta Battery out of Monticello. I'll give you that idea of what that looks like, and then just the members to let you look at what the license plate would possibly look like with the decals on it. And the reason that we're bringing forward, I hope that shows up.
Mr. Ness is going to help you out there, Representative
Thank you.
Anderson.
The fiscal bill before you shows $7,000 to for the cost of putting dies in place to make the decals that are going to be included for members of the Iraqi or Afghanistan war. And basically $7,000 for the first year. Members, I'd just like to let you know that just from my inner wing itself at the Minnesota Air National Guard, there's 1,500 members who have been overseas and served. And just talking with the Lieutenant Colonel from the 8th Devils Infantry Division this morning, there's over 10,000 members from her division in Iraq that have served periodically throughout the time. And so there's lots of people going to be advocating or purchasing this, and I think that the cost for putting the dies in place will more than adequately cover the cost of getting them out there. And Madam Chair, I'd like to have my testifiers speak on and not belabor this anymore.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Anderson, and I'm sorry, gentlemen, we're very short on time. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Herrick. I'm a Staff Sergeant in the Air Force Reserve. I've been in 10 years, and plan to finish out my career with another 10. You know most of the details of this file, so what I will just say is, as it was put on a previous committee, very simply, for all other wars, Minnesotans who have served in those have had an opportunity to represent their service with a license plate, and there's no reason members of the military like myself and others should not have that same opportunity. That's it.
Thank you very much, sir. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, my name is, and members of the committee, I'm sorry. My name is Bob Timperley, and I'm here testifying in proxy for my son, Adam, who is a member of the 216th ADA Delta Battery, and I will respect the time the committee has not left to allow for the 7 pages of testimony I was going to give.
And we do take copies.
Well, it's just bullet points, but much of it you've heard and much of what has been said has demonstrated from the veteran's viewpoint, the soldier's viewpoint, why we all believe they deserve this honor. I guess I'd like to just say two things as my comments. Number one, there's a residual benefit to this. We not only honor the soldiers, but for those soldiers that have volunteered to serve in harm's way, the rest of us are here enjoying a pretty good life. And I find that myself, I'm a busy man, I own a business, I work a lot of hours, I drive a lot, I get frustrated. I drive down the road and I happen to see a veteran's plate, and I'm reminded that what I enjoy has been paid for over and over and over again. And if anyone deserves $7,000 to be spent honoring them, this group of people deserves that. And I'd just like to close by asking you to share with me a prayer of thanksgiving. My son and another member of Delta 216 are home. They have Purple Hearts. The other 155 members are out of Iraq, out of patrolling the 6 most dangerous miles in all of Iraq, the road from the airport to the Green Zone, and they're safe in Kuwait and will be arriving home in the next few days. And for this, I'm blessed and thankful. And I would urge you to pass this bill on, not only to honor these soldiers, but to remind all of us that we live in the land of the free, not only the home of the brave, but because of the brave.
Thank you very much, Mr. Timperley. And I don't know if Representative Anderson told you the process here. Bills that cost money, travel and finance bills, and we wrap those up in mid to late April. And so that's why we hold the bill over for possible consideration in the omnibus finance bill, because they can't move alone if they cost money. Is there any questions or comments on the Representative Anderson's bill? Representative Anderson, if you'd like to renew your motion.
Madam Chairman, members, I'd like to renew my motion for House File 171 to be considered for inclusion in the omnibus transportation bill.
All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Just a quick reminder, Tuesday's meeting will be held in the basement hearing room. And with that, everybody have a good weekend, and the meeting's adjourned.